Hand hunger, I mean.
Hush, you two. The thing has ears, Nanny said.
Madame Morrible was glancing through the financial papers, making a few marks in the margin before she deigned to acknowledge her students.
This won't take but a moment, she said. I've had a letter from your dear father, and a package for you. I thought it kindest to deliver the news myself.
News? Said Nessa Rose, blanching.
He could have written to us as well as to you, said Elphaba.
Madame Morrible ignored her.
He writes to ask of Nessa Rose's health and progress, and to tell you both that he is going to undertake a fast and penance for the return of Ozma Tipitarius.
Oh, the blessed little girl, said Nanny, warming to one of her favorite subjects. When the wizard took over the palace all those years ago, and he had the Ozma regent jailed, we all thought that the sainted Ozma child would call down disaster upon the wizard's head, but they say she's been spirited away and frozen in a cave, like Lurlina. Has Frexbar got the metal to melt her? Is now her time to return?
Please, said Madame Morrible to the sisters, with a sour glance at Nanny. I haven't asked you here so that your Nanny could discuss this contemporary apocrypha, nor to slander our glorious wizard. It was a peaceful transition of power. That the Ozma regent's health failed while under house arrest was a mere coincidence, nothing more. As to the power of your father to raise the missing royal child from some unsubstantiated state of somnolence, well, you've as much as admitted to me that your father is erratic, if not mad. I can only wish him health in his endeavours. But I feel it my duty to point out to you girls that we do not smile on seditious attitudes at Craig Hall. I hope you have not imported your father's royalist yearnings into the dormitories here.
We assign ourselves to the unnamed god, not to the wizard nor to any possible remnant of the royal family, Nessa Rose said proudly. I have no feeling on the matter at all, muttered Elphaba, except that father loves lost causes.
Very well, said the head. As it should be. Now, I have had a package for you.
She handed it to Elphaba, but added, It is for Nessa Rose, I think. Open it, Elfie, please, said Nessa Rose. Nanny leaned forward to look. Elphaba undid the cord and opened the wooden box. From a pile of ash shavings, she withdrew a shoe, and then another. Were they silver, or blue, or now red, lacquered with a candy-shell brilliance of polish? It was hard to tell, and it didn't matter. The effect was dazzling. Even Madame Morrible gasped at their splendor. The surface of the shoes seemed to pulse with hundreds of reflections and refractions. In the firelight, it was like looking at boiling corpuscles of blood under a magnifying glass.
He writes that he bought them for you from some toothless tinker-woman outside Ovel's, said Madame Morrible, and that he dressed them up with silver glass beads that he made himself, that someone had taught him to make.
Turtle heart, said Nanny darkly.
And,
Madame Morrible flipped the letter over, squinting,
he says he had hoped to give you something special before you left for university, but in the sudden circumstances of Amma Clutch's sickness, blah, blah, he was unprepared. So now he sends them to his Nessa Rose to keep her beautiful feet warm and dry and beautiful, and he sends them with his love.
Elphaba drove her fingers through the curlicues of shavings. There was nothing else in the box, nothing for her.
"Aren't they gorgeous?" Nessa Rose exclaimed.
Elfie, fix them on my feet, would you please? Oh, how they sparkle!
Elphaba went on her knees before her sister. Nessa Rose sat as regal as any Ozma, spine erect and face glowing. Elphaba lifted her sister's feet and slipped off the common house slippers and replaced them with the dazzling shoes.
"How thoughtful he is," said Nessa Rose.
"Good thing you can stand on your own two feet, you," muttered Nanny to Elphaba, and put her old hand patronizingly on Elphaba's shoulder blades, but Elphaba shrugged it away.
"They're just gorgeous," said Elphaba thickly. "Nessa Rose, they're made for you. They fit like a dream."
"Oh, Elfie, don't be cross," Nessa Rose said, looking down at her feet. "Don't ruin my small happiness with resentment, will you? He knows you don't need this kind of thing."
"Of course not," said Elphaba. "Of course I don't."
That evening, the friends risked breaking curfew by ordering another bottle of wine. Nanny tutted and fretted, but as she kept downing her portion as neatly as anyone else, she was overruled. Fiyero told the story of how he had been married at the age of 7 to a girl from a neighboring tribe. They all gawped at his apparent lack of shame. He had only seen his bride once, by accident, when they were both about 9.
"I won't really take up with her until we are 20, and I'm now only 18, he added.
With the relief of imagining he might still be as virginal as the rest of them, they ordered yet another bottle of wine. The candles guttered, a small autumnal rain fell. Though the room was dry, Elphaba drew her cloak about her, as if anticipating the walk home. She had gotten over the sting of being overlooked by Frex. She and Nessa Rose began to tell funny stories about their father, as if to prove to themselves and to everyone else that nothing was amiss. Nessa Rose, who wasn't much of a drinker, allowed herself to laugh.
"Despite my appearance, or maybe because of it, he always called me his beautiful pet," she said, alluding to her lack of arms for the first time in public. "He would say, 'Come here, my pet, and let me give you a piece of apple.' And I would walk over as best I could, tilting and tottering if Nanny or Elfie or Mother wasn't around to support me, and fall into his lap and lean up smiling, and he'd drop small pieces of fruit into my mouth."
"What did he call you, Elfie?" asked Glinda.
"He called her Fabula," interrupted Nessa Rose.
At home only," Elphaba said.
"True, you are your father's little Fabula," crooned Nanny almost to herself, just outside the circle of smiling faces. "Little Fabula, little Elphaba, little Elfie."
"He never called me pet," said Elphaba, raising her glass to her sister.
"But we all know he told the truth, as Nessa Rose is the pet in the family, hence those splendid shoes."
Nessa Rose blushed and accepted a toast.
"Ah, but while I had his attention because of my condition, you captured his heart when you sang," she said.
"Captured his heart? Ha! You mean I performed a necessary function."
But the others said to Elphaba,
"Oh, do you sing?
Well then, sing! Sing you must! Another bottle, another glass! Push back the chair, and before we leave for the night, you must sing. Go on."
"Only if the others will," said Elphaba, bossily. "Bach, some Munchkinlander spinel, Averick, a Gilliconese ballad, Glinda, Nanny, a lullaby."
"We know a dirty round. We'll go next if you go," said Crope and Tibbet.
"And I will sing a Vincus hunting chant," said Fiyero. Everyone chortled with pleasure and clapped him on the back.
So then Elphaba had to stand, push her chair aside, clear her throat, and sound a note into her cupped hands, and start, as if she were singing for her father again after all this time. The bar mother slapped her rag at some noisy older men to shush them, and the dart players dropped their hands to their sides. The room quieted down. Elphaba made up a little song on the spot, a song of longing and otherness, of faraways and future days. Strangers closed their eyes to listen. Bach did too. Elphaba had an okay voice. He saw the imaginary place she conjured up, a land where injustice and common cruelty and despotic rule and the beggaring fist of drought didn't work together to hold everyone by the neck. No, he wasn't giving her credit. Elphaba had a good voice. It was controlled and feeling and not histrionic. He listened through to the end, and the song faded into the hush of a respectful pub. Later, he thought, the melody faded like a rainbow after a storm, or like winds calming down at last, and what was left was calm and possibility and relief. "You next, you promised," cried Elphaba, pointing at Fiero. But nobody would sing again, because she had done so well. Nessa Rose nodded to Nanny to wipe a tear from the corner of her eye. "Elphaba says she's not religious, but see how feelingly she sings of the afterlife," said Nessa Rose, and for once no one was inclined to argue. Early one morning, when the world was hoary with rime frost, Grammatik arrived with a note for Glinda. Amma Clutch, it seemed, was on her way out. Glinda and her roommates hurried to the infirmary. The head met them there and led them to a windowless alcove. Amma Clutch was thrashing about in the bed and talking to the pillowcase. "Don't put up with me," she was saying wildly. "For what will I ever do for you? I will abuse your good nature, ducky, and rest my oily locks upon your fine close weave, and I will be picking with my teeth at your lacy appliqued edge. You are a stupid nuisance to allow it, I say. I don't care about notions of service. It's all bunk, I tell you, bunk." I'm a clutch, it's me," said Glinda. "Listen, dear, it's me. It's your little Glinda." I'm a clutch turned her head from side to side. "Your protest is insulting to your forebears," she went on, rolling her eyes toward the pillowcase again. "Those cotton plants on the banks of Restwater didn't allow themselves to be harvested so you could lie down like a mat and let any filthy person slobber all over you with night drool. It don't make a lick of sense." "Amma," Glinda wept, "please, you're raving." "Aha, I see you have nothing to say to that," said Amma Clutch with satisfaction. "Come back, Amma, come back one more time before you go." "Oh, sweet Lurline, this is dreadful," Nanny said. "Darlings, if I ever get like this, poison me, will you?" "She's going. I can see it," Elphaba said. "I saw it enough in Quaddling Country. I know the signs. Glinda, say what you need to say quickly." "Madame Morrible, may I have privacy?" Glinda said.
"I will stay by your side and support you. It's my duty to my girls," said the head, settling her ham-like hands determinedly on her waist. But Elphaba and Nanny got up and elbowed her out of the alcove, down the hall, and through the door, and closed it and locked it. Nanny clucked all the while, saying, "Now isn't that nice of you, Madam Head, but no need, no need at all." Glinda gripped Amma Clutch's hand. Beads of white sweat were forming like potato water on the servant's forehead.
She struggled to pull her hand away, but her strength was going.
"Amma Clutch, you're dying," Glinda said. "And it's my fault."
"Oh, stop," Elphaba said. "It is," Glinda said fiercely. "It is."
"I'm not arguing that," said Elphaba. "I just mean cut yourself out of the conversation. This is her death, not your interview with the unnamed god. Come on, do something."
Glinda grabbed the hands, both hands, even tighter.
"I am going to magic you back," she said between gritted teeth. "Amma Clutch, you do as I say. I'm still your employer and your better, and you have to obey me. Now listen to this spell and behave yourself."
The Amma's teeth gnashed, the eyes rolled, and the chin twisted knobbly, as if trying to impale some invisible demon in the air above her bed. Glinda's eyes shut and her jaw worked, and a thread of sound, syllables incoherent even to herself, came spooling out from her blanched lips.
"Hope you don't explode her like a sandwich," muttered Elphaba.
Glinda ignored this. She hummed and worked, she rocked and panted. Amma Clutch's eyelids moved so frantically over the closed eyes that it looked as if her eye sockets were chewing her own eyes.
"Magic cordium sensus ovinda clenks," Glinda concluded out loud. "And if that doesn't do it, I give up. Even the smells and bells of a full kit wouldn't help, I think."
On the straw pallet, Amma Clutch fell back. A little blood ran from the outer edge of each eye. But the wild turning motion of the focus had shuttered itself down.
"Oh, my dear," she murmured. "So you're all right, then? Or am I dead now?"
"Not yet," said Glinda. "Yes, dear Amma, yes, I'm fine. But, sweetheart, I think you're going."
"Of course I am. The wind is here, can't you hear it?" Amma Clutch said. "No matter. Oh, there's Elfie, too. Goodbye, my ducks. Stay out of the wind until the time is right, or you'll be blown in the wrong direction."
Glinda said, "Amma Clutch, I have something to say to you. I have to make my apology." But Elphaba leaned forward, cutting Glinda off from Amma Clutch's line of sight, and said, "Amma Clutch, before you go, tell us who killed Dr. Dillamond."
"Surely you know that," Amma Clutch said.
"Make us sure," Elphaba said.
"Well, I saw it. I mean, nearly. It had just happened, and the knife was still there."
Amma Clutch worked for breath.
"Smeared with blood that hadn't had a chance to dry."
"What did you see? This is important."
"I saw the knife in the air. I saw the wind come to take Dr. Dillamond away. I saw the clockwork turn and the goat's time stop."
"It was Grammatic, wasn't it?" Elphaba murmured, trying to get the old woman to speak the words.
"Well, that's what I'm saying, ducky," said Amma Clutch.
"And did it see you? Did it turn on you?" cried Glinda. "Did that make you ill, Amma Clutch?"
"It was my time to be ill," said Amma Clutch gently, "so I couldn't complain. And it is my time to die, so leave me be. Just hold my hand, dear."
"But the fault is mine," began Glinda.
"You would do me more good if you hushed, sweet Glinda, my duck," said Amma Clutch gently, and patted Glinda's hand.
Then she closed her eyes and breathed in and out a couple of times. They sat there in a silence that seemed peculiarly servant-class Gilliganese, though it was hard later on to explain why. Outside, Madame Morrible moved up and down the floorboards, pacing. Then they imagined they heard a wind, or an echo of a wind, and Amma Clutch was gone, and the overly subordinate pillowcase
took a small spill of human juice from the edge of her slackened mouth. The funeral was modest, a lover-and-shove-her affair. Glinda's close friends attended, filling two pews, and in the second tier of the chapel a flock of amas made a professional coterie. The rest of the chapel was empty. After the corpse in its winding sheet slid along the oiled chute to the furnace, the mourners and colleagues retired to Madame Morrible's private parlour, where she proved to have sanctioned no expense in the refreshments. The tea was ancient stock, stale as sawdust, the biscuits were hard, and there was no saffron cream or tamorna marmalade. Glinda said reprovingly to the head, "Not even a small bowl of cream?" And Madame Morrible answered, "My girl, I try to protect my charges from the worst of the food shortages by judicious shopping and by going without myself, but I am not wholly responsible for your ignorance. If only people would obey the wizard absolutely, there would be abundance. Don't you realize that conditions verge on famine, and cows are dying of starvation 200 miles from here? This makes saffron cream very dear in the market." Glinda began to move away, but Madame Morrible reached out a raft of cushiony, bulbous, bejeweled fingers. The touch made Glinda's blood run cold. "I should like to see you and Miss Nessa Rose and Miss Elphaba," said the head. "After the guests leave, please wait behind." "We're nabbed for a lecture," whispered Glinda to the Thropp sisters. "We have to be yelled at." "Not a word about what Amma Clutch said, or that she came back," said Elphaba urgently. "Got that, Nessa? Nanny?" They all nodded. Bach and Averick, making their goodbyes, said that the group was reconvening at the pub in the Regent's Parade. The girls agreed to meet them there after their interview with the head. They would manage a more honest memorial service for Amma Clutch at the Peach and Kidneys. When the small crowd had dispersed, only Grammatic clearing away the cups and crumbs, Madame Morrible herself banked up the fire, a gesture of chumminess lost on no one, and sent Grammatic away. "Later, thingy," she said. "Later. Go lubricate yourself in some closet somewhere." Grammatic wheeled away with, if it was possible, an offended air. Elphaba had to repress an urge to kick it with the tip of her stout black walking boot. "You too, Nanny," Madame Morrible said. "A little break from your labours." "Oh, no," Nanny said. "Nanny doesn't leave her Nessa." "Yes, Nanny does. Her sister is perfectly capable of caring for her," said the head. "Aren't you, Miss Elphaba, the very soul of charity?" Elphaba opened her mouth. The word soul always provoked her, Glinda knew, but closed it again. She made a wincing nod toward the door. Without a word, Nanny got up to leave, but before the door closed behind her, Nanny said, "It's not my place to complain, but really, no cream at a funeral?" "Help," said Madame Morrible when the door closed. But Glinda wasn't sure if this was a criticism of servants or a bid for sympathy. The head rallied herself by arranging her skirts and the vents and braids of her smart parlor jacket. In orangey copper sequins, she looked like a huge, upholstered, upended goldfish goddess. How ever did she get to be head? Glinda wondered. "Now that Amma Clutch has gone to ash, we shall, nay, we must move bravely on," Madame Morrible began. "My girls, may I first ask you to recount the sad story of her last words. It is essential therapy on your recovery from grief." The girls didn't look at one another, Glinda, in this situation the spokesperson, took a breath and said, "Oh, she spewed nonsense to the last."
"No surprise, the dotty old thing," said Madame Morrible. "But what nonsense?"
"We couldn't make it out," said Glinda.
"I had wondered if she talked about the death of the goat."
Glinda said, "Oh, the goat! Well, I could hardly tell."
"I suspected that in her deranged condition she might return to that critical moment. The dying often try to make sense at the last possible moment of the puzzles of their lives. Useless effort, of course. No doubt Amma Clutch was puzzled by what she came across, the goat's body, the blood, and Grammatic."
"Oh," said Glinda faintly. The sisters beside her were careful not to stir.
"That terrible morning I was up early at my spiritual meditations, and I noticed the light in Dr. Dillamond's lab. So I sent Grammatic over with a cheering pot of tea for the old goat. Grammatic found the animal slumped over a broken lens. He'd apparently stumbled and severed his own jugular vein. Such a sad accident, born of academic zeal, not to say hubris, and a pitiful lack of common sense. Rest. We all need rest. The brightest of us need our rest. Grammatic, in its confusion, felt for a pulse. None to be found. And I surmise that is just when Amma Clutch arrived. To see dear Grammatic splashed with the spurts of a strong circulatory pulse. Amma Clutch arrived out of nowhere, and none of her business, I might add, but let's not malign the dead, shall we?"
Glinda gulped back new tears, and did not mention that Amma Clutch had mentioned seeing something unusual the evening before, and had wandered out to check.
"I did always think that the shock of all that blood might have been the final straw that sent Amma Clutch pitching back into her ailment. Incidentally, you see why I dismissed Grammatic just now. It's still very sensitive, and suspects, I believe, that Amma Clutch thought it responsible for the goat's slaughter."
Glinda said waveringly, "Madame Morrible, you should know that Amma Clutch had never suffered such a disease as I described to you. I invented it. But I didn't assign it. I didn't commit it to her, or her to it."
Elphaba looked at Madame Morrible steadily, keeping her interest modest. Nessarosa's eyelashes fluttered. If Madame Morrible knew Glinda's news already, her face didn't give her away. She looked as placid as a tethered rowboat.
"Well, this only lends weight to my observations," she allowed. "There is an imaginative, even a prophetic power in your pointed little society skull, Miss Glinda."
The head stood, her skirts rustling, wind through a field of wheat.
"What I say now, I say in strictest confidence. I expect my girls to obey my command. Are we agreed?"
She seemed to take their stunned silence as assent. She looked down on them. That's why she seems so like a fish, Glinda suddenly thought. She hardly ever blinks.
"By an authority vested in me that is too high to be named, I have been charged with a crucial task," said the head, "a task essential to the internal security of Oz. I have been working to fulfill this task for some years, and the time is right, and the goods are at my disposal."
She scrutinized them. They were the goods.
"You will not repeat what you hear in this room," she said. "You will not want to. You will not choose to, and you will not be able to. I am wrapping each one of you in a binding cocoon as regards this very sensitive material. No. She held up a hand at Elphaba's protest. No, you have no right to object. The deed is already done, and you must listen and be open to what I say.
Glinda tried to examine herself to see if she felt wrapped or bound or spell-chilled, but she only felt frightened and young, which may be close to the same thing. She glanced at the sisters. Nessa Rose, in her dazzling shoes, was back in her chair, nostrils dilating in fright or excitement. Elphaba, on the other hand, looked as stolid and cross as usual.
"You live in a little womb here, a tight little nest, girl with girl. Oh, I know you have your silly boys on the edge, forgettable things. Good for one thing only, and not even reliable at that. But I digress. I must say that you know little or nothing of the state of the nation today. You have no sense of the pitch of unrest to which things have mounted, setting communities on edge, ethnic groups against one another, bankers against farmers and factories against shopkeepers. Oz is a seething volcano, threatening to erupt and burn us in its own poisonous pus. Our wizard seems strong enough. Ah, but is he? Is he really? He has a grasp of internal politics. He's no slouch at negotiating rates of exchange with the bloodsuckers of Ev or Jemico or Fleon. He rules the Emerald City with an industry and an ability that the decaying, knob-jawed Ozma line never dreamed of. Without him, we'd have been swept away in firestorm years ago. We can but be grateful. A strong fist does wonders in a rotten situation. Walk softly, but carry a big stick. I see I offend. Well, a man is always good for the public face of power, no? Yes, but things are not always as they seem. And it has been clear for some time that the wizard's bag of tricks would not do forever. There are bound to be popular uprisings, the stupid, senseless kind, in which strong, dumb people enjoy getting killed for the sake of political changes that'll be rolled back within the decade. Add such meaning to meaningless lives, don't you think? One can't imagine any other reason for it. At any rate, the wizard needs some agents. He requires a few generals. In the long run. Some people with managing skills. Some people with gumption. In a word, women. I have called you three girls in here. You are not women yet, but the moment is closing in on you faster than you might think. Despite my opinion as to your behavior, I have had to single you out. There is more in each one of you than meets the eye. Miss Nessa Rose, being the newest, you are the most hidden to me. But once you outgrow that fetching habit of faith, you will display a ferocious authority. Your bodily disorder is of no significance here. Miss Elphaba, you are an isolate. And even in my binding spell, you sit there stewing in scorn of every word I say. This is evidence of great internal power and force of will, something I deeply respect, even when marshaled against me. You have shown no sign of interest in sorcery, and I don't claim you have any natural aptitude, but your splendid lone wolf spit and spirit can be harnessed. Oh, yes, it can. And you needn't live a life of unfulfilled rage. And Miss Glinda, you have surprised yourself with the talents at sorcery you possess. I knew you would. I had hoped your inclinations might rub off on Miss Elphaba, but that they haven't is only firmer proof of Miss Elphaba's iron character. I see in your eyes you all question my methods. You think, somewhat wildly, did horrible Morrible cause that nail to pierce my armor clutch's foot, making me have to room with Elphaba? Did she cause armor clutch to come downstairs and find the dead goat, the better to get her out of the way and require Nanny, and thus Nessa Rose, to show up on the scene? How flattering that you even imagine I have such power!
The head paused and came near to blushing, which in her was something like the separating of cream on a flame set too high.
"I am a handmaiden at the service of superiors," she continued, "and my special talent is to encourage talent. In my own small way, I have been called to a vocation of education, and here I make my little contributions to history. Now, to be specific, I want you to consider your futures. I would like to name you, to baptize you, as it were, as a trio of adepts. In the long run, I would like to assign you behind-the-scenes ministerial duties in different parts of the country. I am empowered to do this, remember, by those whose bootstraps I am not worthy to lick."
But she looked smug, as if she thought herself quite worthy enough, indeed, of attention from these mysterious forces.
"Let us say you will be secret partners of the highest level of government. You will be anonymous ambassadors of peace, helping to restrain the unruly element among our less civilized populations. Nothing is decided yet, of course, and you do have a say in the matter. A say to me, and not to each other, nor anyone else, as the spell goes. But I would like you to think about it. I need, eventually, to place an adept in Gilliken somewhere.
Miss Glinda, with your middle-range social position and your transparent ambitions, you can slime your way into ballrooms of Margreaves and still be at home in the pigsties.
Oh, don't squirm so. Your good blood is only on one side, and it's not a terribly refined strain, anyway. The adept of Gilliken, Miss Glinda, does it appeal?"
Glinda could only listen.
"Miss Elphaba," said Madame Morrible, "full of the teenage scorn of inherited position, you are nonetheless the Thropp third descending, and your great-grandfather, the eminent Thropp, is in his dotage. One day you will inherit what is left of Colwyn Grounds, that pretentious pile in Nest Hardings, and you could manage to be the adept of Munchkinland. Your unfortunate skin condition notwithstanding, indeed perhaps because of it, you have developed a feistiness and an iconoclasm that is just faintly appealing when it doesn't nauseate. It will come in service, believe me. And Miss Nessa Rose," she went on, "having grown up in Quadling country, you will want to return there with Nanny. The social situation in Quadling country is such a mess, what with the decimation of the squelchy froglet population, but it may come back in small measure, and there should be someone to oversee the ruby mines. We need someone to look after things in the south. Once you recover from your religious mania, it'll be a perfect setting. You don't expect a life of high society anyway, not without arms. After all, how can one dance without arms? As for the Vincus, we don't imagine we'll need an adept stationed there, at least not in your lifetimes. The master plans eradicate any appreciable population in that godforsaken place."
Here the head paused and looked around.
"Oh, girls, I know you are young. I know this grieves you. You mustn't think of it as a prison sentence, though, but an opportunity. You ask yourselves, how will I grow in a position, albeit a silent one, of prominence and responsibility? How may my talents flourish? How, my dears, how may I help my Oz?"
Elphaba's foot twisted, caught the edge of a side table, and a cup and saucer fell to the floor and smashed.
"You're so predictable," said Madame Morrible, sighing. "That's what makes my job so easy. Now, girls, bound as you are to an oath of silence, I bid you to go away and think on what I have said. Please don't even try to discuss it together, as it'll just give you a headache and cramps. You won't be able to manage it. Sometime in the next semester, I will call each of you in here, and you can give me your answer. And if you should choose not to help your country in its hour of need..." She clasped her hands in a parody of despair.
"Well, you are not the only fish in the sea, are you?"
The afternoon had turned glowery, with heaps of plum-colored clouds in the north, beyond the bluestone spires and steeples. The temperature had dropped 20 degrees since the morning, and the girls kept their shawls pulled close as they walked to the pub. Nanny, shivering in the dirty wind, cried,
"And what did the old busybody have to say that I couldn't be allowed to hear?"
But there was nothing they could say. Glinda couldn't even meet the other's eyes.
"We'll lift a glass of champagne for Amma Clutch," said Elphaba finally, "when we get to the peach and kidneys." "I'd settle for a spoonful of real cream," said Nanny. "How pinching that old sow is! No respect for the dead."
But Glinda found that the binding spell was deeper, cut closer than she had even understood. It wasn't merely that they couldn't talk about it. Already she had begun to lose the words about it, to falter in her thinking, to fail to commit the interview to memory. There was the proposal. It was a proposal, wasn't it? Of some questionable proposition in, was it the civil service? Doing some ballroom dancing, which didn't make sense. Some laughing, a glass of champagne, a handsome man taking off his cummerbund and pressing his starched cuffs against her neck, nibbling the teardrop-shaped rubies at her ears. Talk softly, but carry a bit stick. Or was it not a proposal, but a prophecy? A little friendly encouragement about the future. And she had been alone. The others hadn't been listening. Madame Morrible had spoken directly to her. A lovely testimony to Glinda's potential. The chance to rise. Walk softly but marry a big prick. A man draping his evening tie on a bedstead and rolling his diamond studs, nudging them with his nose down the declivity of her superior neck. It was a dream. Madame Morrible couldn't have said that. She must be dazed with grief. Poor Amma Clutch. It had only been a quiet word of condolence from the dear and self-effacing head, who found it hard to speak in public. But a man's tongue between her legs, a spoonful of saffron cream. Nessa Rose said, "Catch her. I can't. I'm—" And she sagged against Nanny's bosom, and Glinda swooned at the same moment. Elphaba thrust out strong arms and scooped Glinda in mid-collapse. Glinda didn't really lose consciousness, but the uncomfortable physical nearness of hawk-faced Elphaba after that undesired act of desire made her want to shiver with revulsion and to purr at the same time.
"Steady on, girl, not here," said Elphaba. "Resist, come on."
Resist was just what Glinda didn't want to do. But after all, in the shadow of an apple cart, on the edge of the market where merchants were selling the last fish of the day cheap, well, this was hardly the place.
"Tough, tough skin," said Elphaba,
appearing to pull words from the back of her throat.
"Come on, Glinda. You've got better brains. Come on. I love you too much. Snap out of it, you idiot."
"Well, really," she said, as Elphaba dumped her on a heap of moldy packing straw.
"No need to be so romantic about it."
But she felt better, as if a wave of illness had just passed.
"You girls, I tell you, the faints. It comes from those tight shoes," said Nanny,
huffing and loosening Nessa Rosa's glamorous footwear.
"Sensible folk wear leather or wood."
She massaged Nessa Rosa's insteps for a minute, and Nessa Rosa moaned and arched her back, but began in a few moments to breathe more normally.
"Welcome back to Oz," said Nanny after a while. "What goodies were you all snacking on in there with the head?"
"Come on, they're waiting," said Elphaba. "No sense dawdling. Anyway, I'm afraid it might rain." At the Peach and Kidneys, the rest of the gang had commandeered a table in an alcove several steps above the main floor. They were well into their cups by that point in the afternoon, and it was clear tears had been shed. Averick sat slouched against the brick wall of the student den, one arm slung around Fiero, and his legs stretched out in Shen Shen's lap. Bok and Crope were arguing about something, anything, and Tibbet was singing an interminable song to Fanet, who looked as if she wanted to drive a dart into the thick of his thigh.
"Ah, the ladies," slurred Averick, and made as if to rise.
They sang and chattered and ordered sandwiches, and Averick plunked down an embarrassment of coins to demand a salver of saffron cream in Amma Clutch's memory. Money did wonders, and the cream was found in the larder, which gave Glinda an uneasy feeling, though she didn't know why. They spooned the airy mounds into one another's mouths, sculpted with it, mixed it in their champagne, threw it in small gobbets at one another, until the manager came over and told them to get the hell out. They complied, grumbling. They didn't know it was the last time they would all be together, or they might have lingered. A brisk rain had come and gone, but the streets were still noisy with runoff, and the lamplight glistened and danced in the silvery black curvets of water caught among the cobbles. Imagining the possible brigand in the shadows, or the hungry wanderer lurking nearby, they stood close together.
"I've got an idea," said Averick, putting one foot this way and the other that, as if he were as flexible as a man of straw. "Who's man enough for the philosophy club tonight?"
"Oh, no, you don't," said Nanny, who hadn't had that much to drink.
"I want to go,"
whined Nessa Rose, swaying more than usual.
"You don't even know what it is," said Bok, giggling and hiccuping.
"I don't care. I don't want to leave tonight,"
Nessa Rose said.
"We only have one another, and I don't want to be left out, and I don't want to go home."
"Hush, Nessa. Hush, hush, my pretty," said Elphaba. "That's not the place for you or me either. Come on, we're going home. Glinda, come on."
"I have no armor now," said wide-eyed Glinda, stabbing a finger toward Elphaba. "I am my own agent.
I want to go to the Philosophy Club and see if it's true.
The rest can do what they want, but we're going home, said Elphaba.
Glinda veered over toward Elphaba, who was homing in on a very uncertain-looking Bok.
Now, Bok, you don't want to go to that disgusting place, do you? Elphaba was saying. Come on, don't let the boys make you do something you don't want.
You don't know me, he said, appearing to address the hitching post. Elfie, how do you know what I want? Unless I find out,
Come with us, said Fiero to Elphaba.
Please, if we ask you politely.
I want to go too, whined Glinda.
Oh, come, Glinny-dinny, said Bok. Maybe they'll pick us, for old time's sake, as never was.
The others had awakened a slumbering cab driver and hired his services.
Bok, Glinda, Elfie, come on, Averick called from the window. Where's your nerve?
Bok, think about this, Elphaba urged.
I always think, I never feel, I never live, he moaned. Can't I live once in a while? Just once? Just because I'm short? I'm not an infant, Elfie.
Not till now, said Elphaba.
Rather smarmy tonight, thought Glinda, and wrenched herself away to climb into the cab. But Elphaba grabbed her by the elbow and pivoted her around.
You can't, she whispered. We're going to the Emerald City.
I'm going to the Philosophy Club with my friends.
Tonight, hissed Elphaba, you little idiot. We have no time to waste on sex.
Nanny had led Nessa Rose away already, and the cabby clucked his reins, and the equipage lumbered away. Glinda stumbled and said,
What did you think you were just about to say?
To say? I already said it, and I'm not saying it again, said Elphaba. My dear, you and I are going back to Craige Hall tonight, only to pack a valise. Then we're away.
But the gates'll be locked.
It's over the garden wall, said Elphaba, and we're going to see the wizard, come what may, and hell to pay.
Bok could not believe he was heading to the Philosophy Club at last. He hoped he wouldn't vomit at a crucial moment. He hoped he would remember the whole thing tomorrow, or at least some kernel of it, despite the headache forming vengefully in the hollows at his temples. The place was discreet, though it was the best-known dive in Shiz. It hid behind a facade of panelled-up windows. A couple of apes roamed the street in front, bouncing troublemakers ahead of time. Averick counted the party carefully as they fell from the cab.
Shen Shen, Crope, me, Bok, Tibbet, Fiero, and Fanay. 7.
Boy, how'd we all fit in the cab? Could hardly fit us, I'd think.
He paid the cabbie and tipped him, in some obscure homage still to Amma Clutch, and then pushed to the front of the silent knot of companions.
"Come on, we're the right age and the right drunk," he said, and to the shadowed face at the window, "7. 7 of us, good sir."
The face came forward to the glass and leered at him.
"The name is Yackle. And I'm not a sir, nor am I good. What kind are you up to tonight, master fellow?"
Speaking through the pane was a crone, with random teeth and a shiny white-pink wig slipping westwards off her pearly scalp.
"Kind," said Averick, then more bravely, "any kind."
"I mean the ticket, sweetbread. Strutting and strumming on the sprung floor, or strumpeting in the old wine cellars?"
"The works," said Averick.
"You understand house rules?
the locked doors, the if-you-pay-you-play policy.
Give us 7 and hurry up about it. We're not fools.
You never are fools, said the beastly woman.
Well, here you are, then, and come what may, or who may.
She affected a stance of virtue, like a painting of a Unionist virgin saint.
Enter and be saved.
The door swung open, and they went down a flight of uneven brick steps. At the bottom of the flight was a dwarf in a purple burnous. He looked at their tickets and said,
"Where are you soft things from? Out of town?"
"We're all at the university," said Averick.
"A motley crew. Well, you've 7 of diamond tickets. See here the 7 red diamonds printed here and here," he said. "Have a drink on the house, watch the girly show, and dance a little if you want. Every hour or so I close this street door and open the next."
He pointed to a huge oak door barred with 2 monstrous timbers in iron hasps.
"You all go in together or you don't go in at all. That's the rule of the house."
There was a chanteuse singing a send-up of What is Oz Without Ozma, and teasing herself with a parrot-colored feather boa. A small band of elves, real elves, tootled and rattled out a tinny accompaniment. Bach had never seen an elf, even though he knew there was a colony of them not far from Rush Margins. "How weird," he said, inching forward. They looked like hairless monkeys, naked but for little red caps, and without any appreciable sex characteristics. They were as green as sin. Bach turned to say, "Look, Elfie, it's like you had a passel of babies." But he didn't see her, and remembered then that she hadn't come. Nor had Glinda, apparently. Damn. They danced. The crowd was the most mixed Bach had seen in some time. There were animals, humans, dwarfs, elves, and several TikTok things of incomplete or experimental gender. A squadron of well-built blonde boys circulated with tumblers of rot-gut squash wine, which the friends drank because it was free.
"I don't know if I want to go any more daring than this," said Fanet to Bach at one point. "I mean, look, that hussy of a baboon is almost out of her dress. Perhaps we should call it a night."
"Do you think?" said Bach. "I mean, I'm game, but if you're feeling uneasy—" Oh, hurrah, a way out. He was feeling uneasy himself. "Well, let's get Averick. He's over there nosing up to Shen Shen." But before they could make their way across the crowded dance floor, the elves began to let out a banshee screech, and the singer thrust out her hip and said, "That's the mating call, dollies, ladies and gentle friends. We're doing, and I do mean doing." She glanced at a note in her hand. 5 black clubs, 3 black clubs, 6 red hearts, 7 red diamonds, and on their honeymoon, isn't it sweet?" She simulated gagging. 2 black spades. Up to the mouth of everlasting bliss, fraidies and gentle hens."
"Averick, no," said Bach.
But the crone from the front, who called herself Yackle, came knocking through the hall, having apparently locked up the front door for the time being, and she remembered the holders of the designated cards and brought them forward with a smile.
"All rides, all riders, on the ready," she said. "Here we be at the shank end of the evening. Lighten up, lads, it's not a funeral, it's an entertainment."
It had been a funeral, Bach remembered, trying to invoke the warm, self-effacing spirit of Amma Clutch. But the time to back out, if such a time existed, had passed. They were swept through the oak doors and along a slightly sloping passage whose walls were padded in red and blue velvet.